Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. That's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, we're happy this morning in this part of Focus 580 to come back to a topic that we've tried to do from time to time, and it's because not only is it we do it because it's just fun to talk about, but also we know people listening have a lot of questions. So we're talking this morning about birds. We'll try to talk a little bit about the health of Illinois' bird population. We're now getting into, or will soon be getting into, migration. So if you just like to see birds and you like to welcome them to your yard, there's a chance that the variety of birds will start to pick up. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that. And any questions that people have, general bird-related questions, our guest will do his best to give you an answer. Michael Ward, he is coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program, and he's also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. He's also, part of his time is in the Natural History Survey, one of the state scientific surveys that's based on the campus of the U of I. He's interested in his research in population dynamics and behavior of birds, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the work that he's done, but you know, as I said, it's the opportunity for people to call in and ask questions. So if you have questions about a particular bird or that there's one that you have seen and you want to know more about it, if you can call in and give us the best description, or maybe you already know what the bird is, you can give us the best description and he'll see what he can tell you. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it. Yep. I think that there are some people, you know, when you get into talking about birds and bird numbers, maybe they would say something like, well, there seem to be plenty of birds around. You know, we look,
right.
You go out to wild areas, you look in your backyard, and there are birds. At the same time, people say, well, but you also have to think about diversity of species,
yep.
Not just total numbers of all birds. So I want to have you talk about this. Now, you're involved in doing a bird census, trying to figure out how many, what species, and to take a look at how that maybe has changed over the last century.
Right. So there's lots of bird censuses out there. There's the spring bird count, the Christmas bird count. But a lot of these censuses are only pretty short in time frame, so last 30 or 40 years. We were really lucky here on campus, and I'm working with a couple other, Jeff Braun and Jeff Walk and a couple other people here on campus. Back in 1906, the first systematic bird survey in North America was conducted by researchers here. Stephen A. Forbes, the founder of the Illinois Natural History Survey, recruited two kind of pseudo-grad students. They hadn't started classes yet, but they were hanging around campus, and put them on a train. And the train stopped in northern Illinois, central Illinois, and southern Illinois. And they got off the train, just walked randomly across the landscape, sleeping in people's barns, sleeping wherever they could. And they just walked, you know, randomly, sampled every habitat. Each footstep they took, they recorded in whatever habitat, and they recorded all the birds they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And it was repeated in the 50s by Dick and Jean Graber, who were at the survey. And so we're lucky to redo this survey and really look at how not only the number of birds, but also the diversity of birds and the range of birds has changed. So we hear a lot about global climate change, and a lot of birds in Illinois have really shifted their range from the extreme southern part of Illinois throughout Illinois. When we talk about numbers of birds, you're right in that we kind of have the same maybe total number of birds out there, but the problem is there's a lot of robins, cardinals, starlings, grackles out there, and at the other extreme, a lot of the birds are kind of typically rare or scarce are really dropping off.
Yeah.
Shrikes, loggerhead shrikes, a lot of the shrubby species, a lot of grassland species. These are birds that, you know, you can go out and still find them if you really put the effort into, but they're right at this cusp. We're worried about that. If we keep going this pace, they're going to really decline.
And is basically the reason habitat loss?
Partially habitat loss. There's sometimes just still habitat there. It's just the size of the habitat, the quality of the habitat is reduced.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it's habitat loss. You look at, over the last 100 years, look at the habitats in Illinois and how they've changed. We've actually gained a little forest maybe. urban area's gone up a little bit, but the biggest change has been farming practices. We don't have pastures. We don't have hay fields anymore. We don't have a lot of small grains. We essentially have corn and soybeans. And so when you lost a lot of these pastures that really are grasslands for birds, it's this grassland. Birds don't have anywhere to breed. Mm-hmm. You know, when the study started in 1906, the prairies were already gone from Illinois, but we still had lots of prairie chickens, lots of grasshopper sparrows, henslow sparrows. And, you know, now the case is, you know, we have one population of prairie chickens left in Illinois. Grasshopper sparrows are declining at alarming rates. And really this kind of – we think the reason for this is loss in a lot of these grasses. And there's other reasons for some decline. Some species have retracted their range south. Other species have been persecuted for some reason or other. DDT has dropped their populations down. So it's a really interesting study because, you know, we have 155 birds we end up sampling, and each one of them has a kind of own little story. And we know what the habitat, the exact spots they were at, and we go back to the exact same spots. And we know 100 years ago there was a bunch of farms and alfalfa, and then in the 50s it was corn and soybeans, and now it's, you know, developments. And so you can – it's really – sends a message home what's changed.
Yeah. And it seems that I expect that those the birds that are doing the best, that is where their numbers are the highest, probably those are going to be those that adapt most easily to living in urban environments and living around people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a real obvious suite of birds we call the cosmopolitan birds, being the robin, cardinal, red-winged blackbird, grackle, and barn swallow. These are birds that pretty much you can go anywhere in Illinois, spend 20 minutes outside, and you're going to detect them one way or the other. Mm-hmm. They're everywhere. Every habitat you go into, you can go in the middle of a cornfield, which doesn't have a lot of birds, and you'll eventually get a robin, a barn swallow, a grackle flying by. These birds are – it's really – we kind of look at it as the homogeneous – the bird community is becoming more similar across all of Illinois.
Yeah. It also strikes me that I think that there are some birds that maybe have adapted better so that we're now seeing them in urban areas and things like Canada geese or maybe even crows. Oh, yeah. It seems to me that I don't remember, you know, decades ago seeing so many crows in urban areas. Yeah. And I suppose there are even now places where birds like turkey vultures have adapted to living in urban areas.
Yeah, those are great. It's very dead on. The Canada geese weren't even detected in 1906 and 56. And now they're a problem. They're pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Turkey vultures were only found in the southern tip of Illinois in 1906. And I kind of think of turkey vultures as really feeder birds to some degree. I mean, they're eating dead stuff. Now we have a lot of cars, a lot of roads. There's a lot of dead stuff. And so they can take advantage of that. And they're moving into towns. I mean, you're right on there. Cooper's hawks, turkey vultures, crows. These were birds that were persecuted 50, 60 years ago. People didn't like raptors and they would shoot at them. You know, I live outside here in town in St. Joe, and we have turkey vultures roosting in our backyard, and that would have been unheard of before because people would have persecuted them. They come into towns now, and, you know, there's dead stuff around there they can feed on. Cooper's hawks is a – you know, a lot of people listening probably have Cooper's hawks in their backyard eating birds.
Yeah.
It's a bird that used to use forests. It was probably persecuted, and now it learned, I can hang out in someone's backyard and pick off birds all day long. It's an easy life. And so – because of that, we're actually making a big effort with the study to actually sample a lot of urban areas. We walked transects through Magnificent Mile in Chicago, a lot of small towns all over the place, because we're thinking 50, 100 years from now, urban areas might be actually one of the best spots for birds. And so it's important to get this baseline of data on what's going on in these urban areas as other birds, like sandhill cranes, a bird that just came off the state endangered list, mm-hmm. Is now using people's backyards and actually terrorizing kids running around their backyards because they're defending their territories. A lot of birds are warning that urban areas have lots of food and there's not, you know, other than cats and dogs, there's not a lot of predators there.
Yeah. I wonder, some of these birds, whether they're likely to become an increasing problem. I guess one of the birds I'm thinking of is the turkey vulture. That turkey vulture is a big bird. It's a very big bird. And if you've never seen one, I think if you came up close and personal with one, you'd want to turn and walk the other direction.
Right. And they do, you know, we have them roosting in our yard, which I appreciate, but my neighbors don't because they do leave a mess. You know, they defecate a lot and there's a big mess underneath the trees. And it'll be a problem. You know, sandhill crane was a problem. It was ripping people's screens off their doors in Chicago suburbs. There's going to be a lot more, you know, human conflicts. Canada geese are a big problem up in Chicago. Ringbill gulls, they close beaches in Chicago because they think E. coli from the gulls are a problem. There's going to be more and more problems, especially because from a human perspective, a lot of times we're now putting the resources into having nice parks and urban areas. In Chicago area, there's great forest preserves. You know, Champaign has good forest preserves. And so as we appreciate this and get more habitat in our urban areas, that's going to draw more more critters, and it's going to cause more conflicts. So.
Yeah. All right. We have a couple of callers here, and let's talk with them, starting with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I was calling to ask about robins. I guess you were saying earlier that they were a bird that was found in town often, but I was not used to seeing them all the way through the winter. I didn't know if there was a change in climate that has pushed them back over here, or in their diets, or if there's more bugs, because I was under the impression they ate worms and bugs primarily. But anyway, we're seeing them kind of all the way through the winter. I didn't know if they were wintering or what the explanation for that was, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, you're dead on right there, especially in Champaign-Urbana, even north of here. Robins are staying all winter, and I think it's two reasons for it. One reason is there's a lot of food available all winter for them. So they do eat worms, but they also eat a lot of fruit. And we now have problems with invasive species such as honeysuckle and up north buckthorn. And honeysuckle holds its berries all the way through winter. And so there's now this ready food supply for them all winter long. Secondly, the winters generally are more mild than they used to be. I mean, we still have some pretty bad times, and it's still pretty cold and snowy. But I think that historically, where there was 4 or 5 days that were so cold and so snowy, the birds would have died. Now they can go huddle in someone's backyard and eat crab apples or honeysuckles and make it through those, you know, 4 or 5 really bad days and make it till the weather gets a little better. We actually are tracking robins in Champaign, where we put radio transmitters on their back and follow them around to see what habitats they use. And a little interesting kind of anecdote, a couple of years ago we were tracking one, and it decided to spend the winter, and it spent the winter till January 5th. And on January 5th, in the middle of the night, it decided it had enough, and it got up and flew all the way down to Kentucky. And it's kind of interesting, you know, what the decision-making process is for these animals. Decide, you know, it could have left in October and gone down to Florida and had a nice winter, but it decided to wait till then. But it's definitely the case. There are a lot more birds are wintering further and further north. And it's, I think it's a combination of things. It's weather's part of it, but there's also more food available. And there's, you know, a big trade-off. So a robin that does hang around in the winter, it's in your backyard right now, it can get the best breeding spot. If it's a male, it can probably get the best females, as opposed to if it has to fly back from Florida, it's going to get back here tired. It's not going to get the best spot. So there's a trade-off from the bird's perspective as well.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Ward. He is coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program and also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. He's also attached the Natural History Survey, and we're here open to your questions this morning about birds. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next caller here in Champaign County, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I heard that Champaign County itself is a bird sink. More birds come in than leave the county. I don't know if that's true. And then secondly, what's the latest information about wind turbines and bird migration and mortality? I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the call.
So I think to some degree, Champaign County can be an ecological sink. That being where maybe forest birds show up, they nest in some of our small woodlots, and because these woodlots look from the outset like a pretty good place to breed. But once they get there, there's so many raccoons, there's so many snakes, there's so many cowbirds which lay their eggs in other birds' nests that they don't end up producing enough young to compensate for mortality in that population. And that's only true for the breeding season. So I think Champaign County might not be the ideal spot for a lot of breeding birds. There's not a lot of grassland. There's not a lot of forest. But I do think Champaign County has some really unique spots for stopover habitat for migrating birds, which I think is what, in the broader sense, the most important aspect of Champaign County, and truthfully most of Illinois, is it provides stopover habitat for these birds that are going from South America to the Arctic. Busey Woods in Urbana is a great example where, you know, probably doesn't have a lot of breeding birds there, and the birds that do breed there maybe don't produce a lot of young, but you can go there in a month and you can see 25 species of warblers, thrushes, vireos, great diversity, and these are birds that are stopping over, refueling, getting fat on their bodies to make the next jump up to the boreal forest. We have another research project with some grad students at the survey looking at golden plovers. So these are shorebirds that have just showed up in the last couple days, and they're not in big numbers yet, but they stop over in Champaign, Ford, down McLean, Livingston counties. And they stop here and they refuel for maybe up to a month before they make the big jump all the way up to the tundra. And so I think in terms of birds, Champaign has, and most of central Illinois, is more important for stopover habitat. And for breeding habitats, it's maybe a bit marginal. And the same vein with the migration, something that makes us really concerned is these wind turbines. Up by Gibson City, you know, there's lots of these big wind farms. We were just up there a couple weeks ago. I think the jury's still out to some degree, but it looks like to me that the wind turbines hit just kind of the belly of the migration. The very the birds that fly the lowest might get picked off by the wind turbines, but it appears that there's not a huge amount of mortality. I think a bigger concern would be cats outdoors or birds flying into windows. One of the things that's come out lately is the bigger issue with wind turbines is bats. So it appears to be killing bats at a much higher frequency than killing birds. And it appears to kill the bats by imploding their lungs by changes in wind and pressure on different sizes of the turbine. So, we need to learn more about the turbines. I don't think it's going to have a major effect on bird populations, but it is something we need to continue to monitor.
Okay. Next caller up is in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I would like to point out to you that a major flyway is over here along the east portion of our state, the Wabash Flyway. You'll see an amazing number of birds up and down along the Wabash River. But the question I really wanted to address to you was something totally different. We all know about the relentless attack on the tropical forest, all the rainforest throughout the world, all south. But here recently, in the last 15, 20 years, we've had a huge attack on the northern forest, all the way around the earth, where they mine oil sands, all kinds of minerals and stuff. That's forcing a lot of changes, along with climate change in the north, which changes the major breeding portions for all these birds. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. It's unfortunate that a lot of our neotropical migrants are getting on both ends. The tropical forests, you know, it's a huge issue. I think the issue is probably still greater in the tropical areas. But the northern forests, you know, these tar sands, other issues up north, are definitely reducing the boreal forest. And you'd see this in there's one species that ornithologists are particularly worried about called the rusty blackbird. We were just lucky enough to see a couple yesterday over at Clinton Lake during an ornithology field trip. But this is a species that's maybe has declined as much as 95% over the last 50 years. They winter in southeast U.S. and floodplain forests and breed in the northern bogs and tundra, the northern bogs. And so it looks like maybe there's something going on their breeding grounds that's detrimental to the population. I know there's lots of research going on the boreal forest, a lot of research in Canada, and the Canadian government's doing a lot of research up there. But I think you're definitely correct in that we need to be worried about both sides. The tropical rainforest and northern forest. Another caveat to that, it tends to be a lot of the birds we see breeding in Illinois that are large oak tree specials like cerulean warblers are really specific to a particular habitat. Once they get down on their wintering area, they're foraging inside a cabana, or their habitat is much broader down there. And so deforestation is obviously a big concern. We need to be worried about that. But you know, they might be a little more flexible, a little more plastic in the tropical wintering time. But in the northern forests, they probably need really pristine, big forests in order to reproduce. And we start hacking that up, we get some major problems.
If I might point out one other thing to the listening public, over here in the eastern portion of the state here, we have some excellent birding opportunities in many areas, all up and down the Wabash, and also in the Danville area. There's a very nice wetlands here that should be visited regularly if you wish to see lots of birds. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll continue. The next caller here up is line number 3, someone calling from Vermilion County. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I farm in Vermilion County, and I'm wondering what advice and strategies do you offer for people like me who farm corn and soybeans pretty intensively, but yeah, we do have some opportunities to establish habitat, farmsteads, areas, drainage, ditch borders, roadsides, that kind of thing. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, well, I'm great. I'm glad you called in. This is a, I think this is something where, generally speaking, in Illinois, we have the greatest potential for impact. A lot of the birds that are declining in Illinois, like Bob Whites and pheasants and eastern kingbirds and shrikes, these are birds that don't need huge expanses of habitat. They need little fence rows, little corridors. Mm-hmm. It appears to me that, looking at aerial photos, that in the 60s, a lot of these fence rows and hedgerows got cut down. And currently, a lot of farmers and a lot of land managers mow their roadsides. I think leaving as much kind of messy stuff along the edges as possible is beneficial to these birds. Where you do seem to find indigo bunnings and thrashers and kingbirds and field sparrows, all these birds that tend to be declining are in these messy little, along the roads. And so I think leaving just little pieces, even though a lot of times I don't think we appreciate a 5 meter wide little swath of some shrubby trees might not be important, but it could harbor, a few pairs of birds, and over a large spatial scale, that can be a lot. The other thing that I'm really excited about is we were able to sample a lot of no-till corn and soybeans, mainly soybeans in the central Illinois, but some no-till corn in southern Illinois. And no-till seemed to have quite a few more birds than traditional tilled corn and soybeans.
How do you account for that?
Well, I think it's all structure. I think that in these soybean fields, the birds fly there, and it's all underneath the soy. It's all kind of bare ground. That if you have a little bit of structure there, even though the plants will be dead, there's something there for some structure for maybe some insects to be on, but also for them to put their nest. I think that leads to this. Now, the one thing we don't know about this is, so there's more birds there, but are they reproducing or not? We don't know that, and we have to do some more research, which we'll do this summer. But just from the monitoring data, there's a huge increase in the diversity and numbers of birds in no-till soy versus soy. Corn, we have a small sample size because there's not too many people doing no-till corn out there. But the few we did find in southern Illinois were great. They had Bob Whites. They had grasshopper sparrows. And I really think it's due to there's just more structure. Birds really respond to structure.
Okay, so more scruffy grass areas, shrub areas, and as well as larger trees.
Exactly, yep.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, great. Thank you. We're already at our midpoint here of this hour of Focus 580. We're talking about birds and inviting your bird questions. And let me introduce again our guest, Michael Ward. He's coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program and visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences, and also has a part appointment at the Illinois Natural History Survey. And if you have questions, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Indiana, in Putnam County. Line number two right here. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you could help me identify a bird.
Sure.
Putnam County's pretty much directly west of Indianapolis, and we have a predator, a hawk out here, about the size of a red tail, but it's completely white. And it has a little mottling on it, maybe a charcoal or a darker gray mottling. What could that bird be?
So you probably already identified it. It's probably a red-tailed hawk. Red-tailed hawks are interesting, especially for bird watchers, in that they can vary from being almost completely black to almost completely white. The white ones are called Kreider's red-tail. It's kind of sort of a subspecies. And the black ones are Harlan's red-tails. But if it's the size of a red tail and it's still around right now and it's pretty much white, it might have a little dark on the back, maybe a little dark on the face sometimes. It's probably the subspecies called a Kreider's red tail.
Kreider's red tail. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, very good. Next caller is Atlanta, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Question. I live in Lone County on a nature preserve that a Natural History Survey employee got dedicated here and 'cause it qualified, and fairly large, and it's a resting place for migrating songbirds, and maybe up to 100 species of migratory birds visit the area every year because it's kind of the only area in Logan County to visit. Now, within a couple miles, a large wind farm has went up that is somewhat in the direct path of 300 feet migrating songbirds. What I heard the other day that they've had less of an impact on migrating birds than at first was thought, but I can't quite believe that, particularly with the red flashing lights. And I just wondered what the latest studies that you've looked at or have been participated in have indicated.
Yeah, so there's a lot of studies that are still underway, but generally it looks like it takes less, doesn't kill that many birds. You know, the red flashing light, there's a really interesting study showing that birds actually fly toward the red flashing light, and you're better off having a white flashing light. But, you know, they're tall, and there definitely could be an issue. But birds gain altitude very quickly. You know, as most of you probably know, all these neotropical migrants are migrating at night. And so they tend to go, you know, a couple, you know, few hundred meters up in the air to start migrating. And so they tend to go straight up and then take off instead of kind of gradually kind of going up, at least as far as we can tell. And so so I doubt it has a huge effect. I mean, I think that the factors affecting birds are the television towers and the radio towers. They have the guide wires. When they get tranced on these red lights, they tend to fly around circles around these towers, and they hit the guide wires. And so I think and those tend to be a little taller than the wind turbines. So, you know, I don't think the turbines are good for birds, but I don't think they're going to have a drastic effect on their populations. People are a little more concerned about those in where there's funneling birds into small kind of corridors. So like out on the East Coast in Cape May or at Whitefish Point, areas where there's large water and all the birds have to fly through one central location. When these birds get up over the landscape, you can look at radar images to see this. They kind of diffuse across all of Illinois. And so, yeah, I don't – a lot of those studies are still out there, but I don't think it's going to be a huge impact from the wind turbines.
Even though the elevation is about right with the prop up at the top, you know, migratory songbirds migrated about the 350-foot level somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's going to be more of an issue on foggy nights for sure, because that kind of pushes birds down a little bit. But I think most of the evidence now is they kind of go over the top of them.
Well, I heard that same thing, so thank you very much. It's good to know that maybe I'm not going to be killing birds instead of saving them.
Right.
There you go. Thanks.
Right,
thank you. Well, you also wonder, is there something else that you could do with the design of the turbine? Anything that you could do to make it more noticeable for the birds so that they'll realize something's there, and instead of going through it, they'll go over.
Right. Yeah, people have worked on that. With bats, I know they're trying to play vocalizations to try to get them to avoid that. You know, for people's own personal, there's elliptical turbines that have kind of a lower profile that probably don't kill any birds. You know, that's something that we looked at, but we haven't quite figured out any kind of way to dissuade the birds. We have done a lot of research to attract birds to certain areas, but to kind of make birds avoid stuff like that, you know, people try to play calls or of predators and stuff, and that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. That's going to be difficult. I think the best thing is just they don't get any higher and put them in kind of don't – they're not going to put them very close to each other anyway because they're going to impact each other. So if you're spaced out pretty far apart – during the day, I think there's pretty little chance of birds going to fly into one during a day. I know there's been instances of birds flying into them during the day, but I think that's probably young birds that are just naive and aren't paying attention. I think at night you're going to get a few birds that are migrating a little bit low, and on foggy nights you might have some more because they kind of migrate a little lower. But generally speaking, I don't think it'll be a huge impact.
All right. On to the next caller. This should be somebody in Piatt County and line four. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
We moved to the country and have left grasses, and we're leaving our ditch grassy, and we have a little woods to the side. But last spring, I was so excited when I saw an indigo bunting. And within the space of about a day, it had, and two others had flown into my south patio door. And I was just, it was just awful. And so I got decals, bird decals to put on the, they don't hit the other patio door, they hit just one patio door. And it's like, why don't robins hit this? You know, I just, is there anything that I can do? I still have the decals up.
The decals can't hurt. This is a big issue. And right now I'm on the committee with up in Chicago on Mayor Daley's Bird Agenda Committee. And this is a big issue in Chicago.
Yeah.
We're turning off the lights in the skyscrapers at night to keep the birds from flying in. But during the day, there's a huge issue. And I think keeping decals on is a good thing. It can't hurt. But generally speaking, the birds are flying around and they're seeing through the window. They're seeing something. In Chicago, especially, you know, in the Loop area, they're seeing actually plants inside in these kind of foyers and are flying toward the plants.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, if there isn't plants inside, they're seeing a light. They're seeing something there. You know, they think they can fly through there. There's probably some plants on the outside, and they kind of see some light behind, so they're thinking, I'm going to fly through these plants.
Yeah.
And so if it's completely dark, I doubt the birds. I had the same issue in my back patio, and We kind of made it a little darker there, and we don't have that issue now, the birds flying in. So I think the best thing you can do is to do that. On a side note, some of the interesting research going on this is that, as many of you may or may not know, birds can see more than we can. They can see in the UV. And so if you actually had double pane glass and you put in, if the manufacturers would do this, put in gas that reflected UV light, the birds might be able to see the windows a little better. So I know some manufacturers are trying to create more bird-friendly windows that maybe we don't see a big difference in, but the birds will see a big difference. But I think those are still – well, first of all, I don't know if there's a market for them. And second, I think even if there is, they're probably years out. So I think the best thing is just reducing the light on the other side and keeping your decals on the window.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. The next caller is in Champaign. It's line number 3. Hello. Caller there in Champaign. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. When I was growing up about 50 years ago in northeast Iowa, we used to see lots and lots of dickcissels, bobolinks, western meadowlarks. When I go up there now, I see not a one of them, and I'm assuming that loss of habitat is primarily responsible. But do you expect that these species are simply going to vanish in vast areas over the next years, or what's the prospect of seeing any kind of return?
Yes, I would agree it's habitat. I think it's mainly loss of, you know, dairy, pastures, hay fields, stuff like that. They're just pretty much gone from the landscape of now being corn and soybeans. I think the best hope for grassland birds like dickcissels and bobolinks and meadowlarks is USDA programs there's a CRP, Conservation Reserve Program. There's a new program in Illinois called SAFE that's kind of similar to that. So these have shown great promise in recovering bird populations. You know, I think that really intensive agriculture is here to stay. And so I think the best kind of programs would be to take some of the land that's not as productive, erodible soils or lower quality soils, and enroll them into some of these programs to kind of get the threshold of the critical mass of habitat back up there. In the Dakotas, I know CRP is really, there's a lot of CRP lands, a lot of grasslands, and they're really seeing a good recovery in a lot of those species. So I think the best chances for Iowa, Missouri, Indiana, Illinois is to really get farmers to enroll in these programs and get more support for these programs for the grassland birds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. One of the things that I wonder about, and it goes back to maybe a little bit of our conversation earlier about how birds have there are more kinds of birds that have adapted to living in urban environments. So we see turkey vultures and crows and Canada geese. And I wonder whether some of the kind of birds that they're not rare, but they're not really city birds, maybe birds like thrashers or indigo bunting, things like that, whether maybe if their habitat, some of their habitat does shrink, that maybe they'll manage to move into the city and adapt a little bit more to city environments. And maybe actually we would start to see more of those kinds of birds.
Right. Well, those you could kind of classify those as shrubland birds. So birds that need kind of messy stuff, not forest, not grassland. Yeah. And there's some evidence that those aren't area-specific birds to breed. So they don't need – most forest birds need, you know, 40, 100 acres to really produce a lot of young. And so we're really kind of pushing that in some urban areas where, you know, the best thing that maybe being done in some Chicago areas, we have little patches here and there, is to get shrublands because maybe you'll have a yellow warbler and a brown thrasher. I think the problem is, I think some of those would probably use urban areas, but currently a lot of our management is at the extremes to some degree. Either we want a nice forest or we want a nice grassland. And we tend to not want kind of the shrubby, you know, sumac and other stuff out there just because we look at that and we don't think that looks good, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. It's funny. When I live in Urbana, and we first bought the place where we live, the people who live next door, their background was really overgrown. We saw brown thrasher all the time. It was perfect for brown thrasher. And then somebody else came in and moved in, some very nice folks. And they've now mowed and they've cleaned up the backyard. So some of those kinds of things that we used to see. Occasionally we still see thrasher, but, you know, I think it was a good place for birds and for those kind of birds just because of that.
Yeah, one of the interesting things so this 100-year bird census, we went to a lot of urban areas, and there was a pretty tight correlation with some of the cities that are and have a greater depression, have lower kind of economic standing, have a lot of delinquent houses, a lot of stuff kind of falling apart, and that's where you get a lot of the good birds. So some of these small towns and, you know, throughout Illinois, but in southern central Illinois, that there's, you know, absentee landowners or what have you, that all were grown, you get a lot of good birds there. And then we go to some of these new developments up in Chicago that are, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, that everything's manicured by some company and there's pretty small trees, and you might as well be in a cornfield. I mean, you get the robin and you get a grackle, but that's about it. And you go to some of the other towns that, you know, don't look very good to us, but they'll have great crested flycatchers, they'll have mockingbirds, they'll have all kinds of stuff taking advantage of this. So I think, you know, from the humans, us getting a little messier, we might benefit some of these shrubland birds.
All right. Next caller is in Pontiac, or sorry, in Potomac, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking
the
call. It's fascinating. But these discussions you've had about birds, the birds that we'd want to see more, being attracted to messy areas. I drive between Danville and Urbana and Potomac and Rantoul a lot through the cropland, and there's opportunities to create that kind of habitat. And I wondered if do you have anything to say about when the farmers get real industrious this time of year and they start burning all the banks down to the water's edge on all the ditches and, you know, burning this
right.
and that. Does that kind of obviate any birds nesting in that area for a long, long time?
I don't think that's too bad. I mean, I think that, I think farmers probably for good reason worry about that if they don't manage some of these waterways that they'll get some recruitment of cherries or some other trees. And as the trees get bigger, they'll shoot out their crops. And I think they're probably worried about that. I would kind of suggest that maybe there's a happy medium in where you can get some sumac, some hawthorn, some honey, maybe not honeysuckle, but some other native shrubs in some of these waterways that provide habitat for yellow warblers and willow flycatchers. It's going to be a little more management because you are going to get recruitment of some of these trees that you probably don't want out there. So it's going to be a different type of management, but there might be some ways to go in that regard.
Yeah, because some of those little waterways through a big field is something on the order of even a quarter mile or so, and, you know, 50 yards, 100, maybe even 60 yards wide, and that would provide quite a bit of habitat.
Right. I think historically these Osage orange fence rows were probably really good habitat, and with a lot of those gone, if there was some kind of, you know, nice structure along some of these waterways, it could provide good habitat for some species.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And next caller is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have an identification question. There's a bird that I get every day in the summer, and I've already started getting it on occasion. I've never seen it, but I know its very distinctive call, and I will. I should whistle it, but I can't whistle, so I'll sing it to you.
Sure.
La 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 la.
Huh. That's a tough one. So it's doing that as whistles, huh? A lot of times the birds that are really loud around our house are cardinals, robins. Those tend to be the ones that people kind of call about making loud noises. So cardinals have a trill kind of going down or up in pitch.
No trill.
No trill. And so robins have it's a sweet call. We refer to it in the class as kind of a sweet note. One resource for what's great for birds and for ornithology these days is that if you go on the web and just Google, you know, backyard birds, you can actually get MP3 or WAV files of all the songs. And so if it's outside making noise, you could, if you have access to the internet, you could just pull it up and see if you can match them up and figure out what it was.
I bought a book of bird calls and I couldn't find it, but it probably was there. Well, thank you very much.
No problem. Good luck.
That sounds to me like it might be a – isn't there a sparrow that does something sort of
– Yeah, white-throated like sparrow does something like that, but it wouldn't be around all summer. They're just a migrant through. Song sparrow have a nice kind of bubbly song. They would be in your backyard, but it would be more complex. That's a tough thing about bird songs. So I teach ornithology here on campus, and we make the students learn bird calls, and it's amazing what sounds like one thing to one person sounds completely different to another, and it makes it tough for them to learn the songs and – but, you know, it's part of the fun of it. So.
All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest for the show is Michael Ward. He is the coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program. He's also a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. And if you have bird-related questions, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things I thought I might ask you about, it has to do with some of the work that you're doing, is about West Nile. And in over the past, I don't know how many years, maybe like 5-10 years, we have seen some really some serious effect, particularly on particular kinds of birds like crows and their relatives, but other birds as well. What's happening now with West Nile?
So it's kind of declined a little bit in Illinois. That's not to say it couldn't fire back up. Birds are definitely a big player in moving this virus around, and there's been a large decline in crows, blue jays, chickadees to some degree, maybe even great horned owls. Crows have declined, and it doesn't look like they're increasing at a very – they've dropped off from a big numbers back in 2001 to being pretty steady the last couple years, and they're not increasing. We do a lot of research on the South Farms where we catch birds, pull blood, look for whether they're exposed, and we hardly get any crows that are exposed. And what that tells us is that they're not developing antibodies, because most birds, you know, they get exposed to West Nile, they die, or they develop antibodies. Most of them develop antibodies. The fact that crows aren't showing any of these antibodies really suggests that they haven't really evolved defenses against West Nile virus. And so it's something that we got some active research going. One of the kind of interesting things that's happened in the last year or two is we found out that the big player is robins. So we can catch mosquitoes, take the blood out of their abdomen, sequence it, and figure out what species they fed on. And it turns out that a lot more than you would expect by chance are robins. And the interesting thing about this in Champaign-Urbana is, and it's probably true everywhere, is that robins go to communal roosts a lot. So they all come together in one particular area. In Champaign-Urbana, this is at Meadowbrook Park, on the edge of Meadowbrook Park. And it kind of looks like that's actually where we see the most West Nile activity. So it could be that mosquitoes are kind of queuing in on where the robins are. Robins are a good host, they amplify the virus, and that's where you get this kind of amplification. And this next coming summer, and they've been doing this for a while now, we're doing this robin research in Chicago, because Chicago is where the West Nile problem is the most significant problem for humans. And so if we can start kind of figuring out what drives where there's going to be a lot of West Nile and when there's not a lot of West Nile, then you can try to do some more kind of mitigative actions to try to reduce mosquito larvae or whatever you want to do to try to stop getting these outbreaks of West Nile.
And is it just a particular kind of mosquito, or is it going to be any?
It's only essentially there's one genus, Culex genus, that carries West Nile virus, and that pretty much only feeds on birds. That's why around here, some people get it, but most of the time it's only confined in the birds, and so that makes it a little easier for us because we can kind of cue in on that species of mosquito, and then we know it's essentially robins and cardinals are the main hosts for it. And so kind of over the course of doing research in the last few years, we've narrowed down. We still haven't got really figured out exactly how the dynamics are going, but we have the key players all figured out, and we're just trying to figure out why one year you have a big spike and the next year you don't have any.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign in line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
A few years ago, about maybe 10 years ago, I lived for 30 years in Charleston. And we had a 60-acre batch of woods. And I always used to hear the whippoorwill. And after about maybe 10 or 12 years, I no longer heard him. Are they common around this area? And do you have any idea why he may have disappeared?
Yeah. I think it's a sad story. So when I grew up in Jacksonville in western Illinois, and where I grew up, there was lots of whippoorwills when I was young, and now they're gone. And this is not just confined to Illinois. There's a big decline in whippoorwills throughout eastern North America. And in fact, the survey and the DNR, and we kind of come together to have a new monitoring program called Moon, which is monitoring of owls and nightjars or something like that, and where we have volunteers go out and look for these whippoorwills. And it's alarming in that we can't find them in a lot of spots. You know, there's still some over by Danville, but in Champaign County, I'm not aware of any. And I think the reason for this, first is – they nest on the forest floor, and a lot of times our forest floor is now covered with garlic mustard or with honeysuckle. And the second thing is there's pretty good evidence that moth populations are really declining over the last decades.
Moths?
Moths, yeah. So they feed primarily on moths. And so the food's gone for them. Their nests are now getting eaten by raccoons if they can even find a place to nest. And so there's still some, you know, if you go over to Western Illinois, Siloam Springs, Adams, Pike County, there's a lot of whippoorwills there. But a lot of these smaller woodlots in Central Illinois, the whippoorwills are gone. And, you know, it is pretty alarming to us. And I hopefully we can figure out and kind of stop this decline.
Oh, thank you. It's too bad.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. To Urbana next. This is line number three. Hello.
Hi. Enjoying the show a lot.
Great.
The guy who sung the bird song he heard, I think I can identify it. I think he did a very nice job of singing it. And I think it's a chickadee.
Oh, that could be correct.
Yeah,
that could be. I mean, Champaign Urbana is interesting because we have kind of both black cap and Carolina chickadees, right, the hybrid zone. And so you can actually get some weird variations on that. So you might be right. It could have been chickadee-dee-dee or the Carolina part where it's doing
right.
that note. So, yeah, that's very good.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Right, thanks. I actually was really surprised now. I don't know when this was, maybe about a month ago or within the last couple of months, I saw a black cap chickadee in my backyard. And that's the first time ever I'd seen one in my yard. And I was really surprised because I didn't think we had the right kind of habitat for them.
Well, I think we have the right habitat. It's just we're in this very weird location where it's the hybrid zone of the Carolina to the south and black cap to the north. And in my yard, I tend to think I get mostly Carolinas, but they can do both calls. And I get them mostly in spring and fall. And, you know, the going kind of idea is they don't migrate very much, but they must be moving somewhat because I always see them during migration in my yard. And so it's interesting because if you go due west of here, you'll start picking up black caps pretty easily. And if you go south toward Charleston, you get a lot of – so we're right at this hybrid zone, and it's a stable hybrid zone. They know it's been stable for the last 50 or so years. And it's just an area where they're coming together, and they both don't like each other, and they kind of – their densities are much lower here in the Champaign-Urbana area.
And I was out, and I heard it call, and I thought to myself, that's a chickadee. I know what that is.
Yeah.
And I looked right up, and it was in a shrub. It was right next to me, and I thought – whoa, I've never seen one of you here before.
Yeah.
I was really surprised and pleased.
Yeah, that's the great thing about birds, and that's, you know, we have the students in ornithology try to get them excited about is, you know, you can go out this week and see a certain cohort of birds, and you go out next week and you get, you know, some of the same, but you can get a whole different, you know, different flavor, different new birds. And, you know, for the next month in Champaign-Urbana, there's going to be all, you know, it's kind of cold and wet today, but as soon as this warms up and a new front comes through, you're going to have a bunch of new birds show up, and it's a lot of fun to go out and see this stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we talk with some more folks here. The next caller is in Champaign in line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yep.
Due to critical trends, the assessment is fairly simplistic. It goes to turbidity and things like that, and you're talking about some biodiversity. We have something like 75 miles of switchgrass along those channels, and it would be nice to do something like what you're suggesting, a few other things, but it needs education. It needs to come from the critical trend base. I seem to think that some other states have more species in their assessment of critical trends. Could you say something about that?
Sure, I can talk about critical trends for hours. So the program we have going is trying to look at how things are changing, randomly selecting sites throughout Illinois and selecting forest, grasslands, and wetlands. And this is funded through the Department of Natural Resources with the idea being that we can kind of figure out what's going on the ground and then pass on the information to them. They can make policy or recommendations to try to get, you know, implement some of the stuff we're seeing. I do think that, you know, some of the policies in Illinois might need to be updated. I think DNR, you know, is coming around. You know, they had some trouble times with the previous governor, and now they're kind of coming around and getting energized, and hopefully they can kind of implement some of the things we're seeing from the science side, implement that into the policy.
Yes. I think a little of the burning is associated with the revitalization of prairie grasses, which is not all the broadleaves, but there's a reason for the burning other than just putting a match in the drainage ditch.
Oh, yeah, I would agree that, you need to, if you didn't burn, you have a problem, and it's, you know, getting the prairie plants, getting the grasses back there. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So we can get at least one more call here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Hearing you talk about whippoorwills, I'm reminded that I heard, now I can't remember which one it was I heard. I heard either a whippoorwill or a bobwhite. I live just east of Orchard Downs. This was last year. That's why I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah.
It was one of those name birds.
Well,
and I was really surprised, and I've never heard it since. But a neighbor also heard it when I was out there looking around to see if I could figure out where it was coming from.
You can hear whippoorwills in migration sometimes. So sometimes they'll stop for a night and they'll make a couple noises. Bob White, I haven't heard this myself, but I am hearing reports that in Meadowbrook, a couple of Bob White have shown up and been hanging around there. So Orchard Downs isn't too far away, and Bob White can wander that way. I wonder a little bit if someone didn't release him, because Champaign's pretty isolated, and there's not a lot of corridors for the Bob White to come in. But I know people have been hearing some Bob White in the Meadowbrook, you know, Forestry, South Farms area. So it could be a Bob White.
Aren't feral cats also a problem in rural areas with these ground nesting birds?
Yeah, feral cats are a problem wherever you are, even in urban areas. I guess good advice would be if you got a cat, keep it on a leash. You know, they kill a lot of birds, especially during migration. These birds are weakened from flying all night, and then, you know, easy meal or easy kind of play toy for a cat. And so I think the rule should be, you know, just try to keep your cat indoors. And if you do let it outdoors, keep it on a leash or keep it in some area away from where birds are at.
We're at the point we're going to have to stop. And I'm sorry, we have some people we can't take. Just as a way of finishing up real quick, if you're just around Champaign-Urbana, where are some of the best places to go if you want to see some birds?
Sure. Meadowbrook is a great place for grassland birds. Busey Woods is, they have a, Audubon has a walk right now. I think it's on Sunday mornings. Busey Woods is getting good right now, and it's going to be great for the next 6 weeks. Early May, you can go there and you can see 100 species of birds. So I'd really recommend Busey Woods, Homer Lake, Kickapoo, Meadow Fork, that area. Those are all good areas as well.
All right. Well, we'll stop right there with our thanks to our guest, Michael Ward. He's visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. Also has part appointment at the Illinois Natural History Survey. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.